I think of Paul Volcker as an ideal winner of the Daniel Patrick Moynihan Prize. Paul has devoted his extraordinary intelligence and energy to doing very hard things in the public interest over a long career and done it with grace and humility. Now, just this week, I testified before the House Financial Services Subcommittee on Monetary Policy, chaired by presidential candidate Ron Paul, which made it a very interesting hearing. I was able to tell that committee that they should not worry about inflation taking off into the stratosphere anytime soon. And I was confident that that statement was true for several reasons. Because unemployment is currently high, because we have a lot of excess capacity, because we have global competition that keeps our prices down. But the main reason is that we have not had significant inflation for three decades. Think about that. Grown-ups, people in their 50s, have not had cause to worry about rising inflation in their entire adult lives. They don't expect it to happen again. They think the Fed will not let it happen. And if they don't expect it, it's much less likely to happen. Now, who's responsible for all that? Actually, the man to whom we are about to give this prize. When Paul Volcker took over the Federal Reserve chairmanship of the Fed in 1979, after an already stellar career at the New York Fed, the Treasury, and in the private sector, the economy was in really bad shape. We had stagflation. Prices rising and unemployment high. That's not supposed to happen. Nobody knows what to do about it. We had, in fact, quite high unemployment and approaching double-digit inflation, which looked like it was going higher, and it did. What turned that around was very aggressive action at the Federal Reserve. It was not popular action. Paul Volcker raised the federal funds rate to 20%. You know what it is now? Virtually zero. Paul Volcker may have been the most unpopular man in America between 1979 and sometime in the mid-80s when it became obvious that the policy was working. He had a heavy security guard, which was not normal in those days for Fed chairman, because a lot of people didn't like what he did. But it's hard to think of anyone who has had a more lasting positive influence on the American economy than Paul Volcker. Monetary policy of 1979 to the mid-80s was just vintage Volcker. Study the problem carefully, take action, study the effects of that action, and do what has to be done to correct the problem, even if nobody loves you for doing it. Now, liberals, and Pat Moynihan was sometimes a liberal, liberals didn't like the Fed actions of that period. They often don't. So I thought I would look for a juicy quote from Pat Moynihan, either on Paul Volcker or on the Federal Reserve. Now, I didn't do a broad study of this, but I did go to Stephen Weissman's excellent collection of Moynihan letters, which is just full of juicy quotes on just about any subject you can think of. And what did I find? Absolutely nothing. That speaks well of Pat. Unlike some politicians, he must have realized that the United States needs a strong, independent central bank, and the less he said about it, the better. Now, Paul is a glutton for punishment. He's taken on a most amazing list of hard, thankless tasks. Straightening out messes, the Holocaust victims' bank accounts, corruption at the UN in the oil for food program in Iraq. Talk about complex, difficult stuff that nobody else would want to take on. If you got one of those, you call Paul. Recently, when he could have retired to bask in his well-earned reputation as a seer and a pundit, he's kept going. He's kept on thinking, writing, testifying, chairing task forces, all aimed at getting the U.S. economy back on track, avoiding another financial meltdown, and stabilizing the debt. I'm particularly grateful to him for his persistent efforts to convince our leaders, so far unsuccessfully, that the U.S. can both recover from a recession and run a responsible long-run fiscal policy. It's not a choice. We've got to do both. So thank you, Paul, for all you've done and are doing, and don't stop now. We need you, and Pat Moynihan would have been proud to have you accept this prize in his name.
Thank you all, Liz, Morn, friends, particularly Alice Rivlin. You know, Alice Rivlin and I had somewhat parallel careers, one way or another. I don't know why we spend all this time in Washington, but we have. And when she came up here and she pulled this microphone down and I put it up, I thought, Alice, maybe we did okay on the average. But we were both here all that time. Why isn't the economy doing better? I won't get into that too deeply this evening, but I do want to make a couple of comments. Some about Daniel Patrick Moynihan, and it is truly an honor, special honor, to receive an award in his name. Everyone here knows that Pat was one of a kind in the political life of our country. I think of all the adjectives: provocative, fearless in attacking accepted wisdom, with fact and analysis, ready to cross political boundaries when in the common interest, always, always ready to prick self-exalted egos and political nostrums. He was a life of a true scholar, an erudite writer, a dedicated public servant, spirited senator, raconteur, and what made it special is he did all those things at the same time. And I kind of forgotten about his physical monuments in this room, and this building is one of them, Pennsylvania Avenue. We've got an actual plaza down there, the Moynihan Plaza. And I have to tell you, I get a warm, fuzzy feeling every time I take the train to New York and the train comes out of the tunnel and I think, here I am in Moynihan Station. And then I realize that's still an imaginary station and Pennsylvania Station is the reality of our life. So Pat's left a few things that the rest of us have to do. But his goodwill and his quick wit surely would have been tried by the present political scene. I was reminded of the fact he didn't like lobbyists. I'm not sure he could have survived in Washington with the number of lobbyists around these days. But the seeming triumph of ideology over analysis, the unwillingness to weigh fresh evidence, the collapse of the middle, Pat had seen a lot of that in his life, but never, I think, to the same extent as now. And when I thought of this, what is this, that all this is happening, the antithesis of his very being? Now, I can't claim to have had entree to Pat's inner group. I hear stories about those Capitol hideaway meetings. You were gracious in not getting into those in full detail. But we did have occasional official and personal contact. Now, as counselor to President Nixon, he counseled me. I was reputedly the only Democrat, subject to confirmation, the only Democrat nominated and confirmed in office. and I needed lessons on how to survive in a Republican administration. Now, at one point, we had very different responsibilities. He was ambassador in India. I was a Treasury official. And we had a fencing match. He decided that the United States ought to cancel debts accumulated by India over a large number of years, accumulated in buying American wheat. He thought that was kind of an unjust debt, particularly since the wheat was partly subsidized for the benefit of American farmers, and he thought that debt ought to be canceled. I have to tell you, he eventually got most of his way, despite my efforts to defend the Treasury fisc, the American fisc. The result was he won on that score, but I got my first trip to India, and I enjoyed the hospitality of the glorious new Moynihan Embassy in India, which was financed by India in rupees in return for the United States for giving all that indebtedness. Now, as it turned out, for better or worse, I survived longer in the Nixon administration than he did. And when I think about it, what a contrast with today. I know there are a lot of feelings about Richard Nixon and his political excesses, and we've all seen some of that. But let me say that hard-wired Republican did manage to work with the Congress to achieve constructive things both in foreign policy and in domestic social programs. I consider that record against a starkly different situation facing the newly elected Barack Obama as he took office, faced from the very start with obdurate opposition to almost anything that he would suggest as an initiative. And so many new appointees received long and difficult treatment as the Congress was prepared to do unprecedented things in terms of the threat of a filibuster to reject or delay important appointments. Now, I must add, when I reviewed these remarks this afternoon, I suddenly had a thought. Did Pat Moynihan, the thought that came to mind, you know, Robert Bork, remember him? Miller. Did Pat Moynihan filibuster the Bork appointment? All I remember, it was very controversial. So I had to do a little quick research. And I will report that for all the controversy, Bork was not filibustered. There was a vote in the Congress. And the vote in the Congress actually had several Republicans voting with the Democrats to reject Bork in a narrow vote, and a half dozen more of Democratic senators voted to support the nomination of Bork. Now, what are the chances of that happening in such a controversial situation today? The pragmatic, typically long-serving middle in the Congress has been decimated. Pat Moynihan served in periods of political strain. He saw a lot of political antagonism. But the divisiveness, the ideological extremes, the intensity of special interests, the amount of money that lobbyists now carry with them, the enormous need for campaign finance is simply without precedent in my lifetime and not in his lifetime either. It's left us poorly prepared for meeting enormous challenges in our economic and political life, in our financial life, an unacceptable level of fiscal realities, the entanglement of wars, and a new balance of global economic power. Now, all of these problems we face seem to be made much more difficult by the fact that days are gone when we Americans could take for granted international economic and political leadership. I think it's fair to say that leadership for decades was respected not just because of military and economic might, but because our open democratic society was in fact attractive, making the American century not only tolerable, but broadly welcomed. Now we have a new reality. We also have a new election. I haven't got any grand proposals to deal with the realities, but in the spirit of Bob Moynihan, I do have a suggestion to help a new administration, whatever the color of the new administration, to get off to a reasonable start. So let me try it out on you. It's widely known that the constitutional process for nominating and confirming a president's senior policy officials has become dangerously distorted, inhibiting prompt leadership, foregoing effective management. The nominating process for dozens of presidential nominees subject to confirmation has become full of pitfalls, high hurdles, and unanticipated obstacles. There is an interminable and duplicative vetting of the financial, business, and personal lives of potential appointees, both by the new administration and separately by the Congress. Then a potential nominee may be left hanging, for not just weeks or months, sometimes for a year or more, awaiting senatorial consent to a presidential appointment. The days and risks of an able and well-respected man or woman willing to take up the gauntlet of public service is daunting. The obvious result is that too many of the highly competent and willing, even those eager to make a contribution, simply refuse to be considered or to wait out the process. The consequence for a new president is that he's left without key members of his team in place for many months, sometimes literally for a year or more. He's crippled in developing, defending, and administering his policies. Now, through the years, and it's also true now, a number of commissions and experienced executives have proposed approaches to speed the process. Yet over time, the appointment process has deteriorated, even as the needs are getting more pressing. Extending that record can't serve the needs of any newly elected president, of his party, and not least of the country. So I do think some rethinking is in order. So I want to propose a kind of litmus test for our collective ability to agree, at least on some procedural points. It's a matter that inherently concerns the interaction of the constitutional responsibilities of the executive and of the Senate. In essence, can we, for instance, build now on the simple fact that before a presidential election, the winner will not be known? I think that is an uncontested fact. At that point, is it not in the interest of both the candidates and their party colleagues in the Senate to seek a mutual disarmament pact with respect to new executive branch appointees? Now, just suppose, specifically, that the party leaders in the Senate and the two presidential candidates were to figuratively hold hands and join in an agreement of this sort. First, establish a common set of vetting requirements of possible presidential appointees. Next, assure that the relevant Senate committee will act in no more than, say, 4 or 5 weeks from the time of a presidential nomination, and that a committee-approved nominee would promptly be sent to the full Senate, committing further that the Senate, in turn, will vote up or down by majority rule within, say, another 4 or 5 weeks. Then provide that the so-called holds by individual senators, and those holds when they're for purposes not directly related to the nominee's personal qualifications, the holds would not be honored, say, after 8 weeks or so after the president sends a nomination to the Senate. And then finally, if the Senate is willing to make those arrangements, should not a president pledge that he will not make recess appointments except in the very rare circumstances of a compelling need during a really extended recess? Now, those are matters that involve responsibilities both of the Senate and of the President, which suggests the logic of a balance of commitments. And no doubt it also involves sensitive questions of Senate rules and, in one limited area, the established prerogatives of individual senators. Senatorial leadership in that effort will be critical, but surely a pledge by the majority and minority leaders of the Senate joining the presidential candidates in the public interest should carry heavy weight. And what presidential candidate could refuse to make such a pledge because it could only be interpreted as the fact that he thinks he might lose the election? After all, the problem is evident. Delay and obstruction has taken the elements of tit for tat. One frustrated party after an election induced to repeat and even outdo the practices of the opponents after the previous election. Now, too much is at stake for poorly partisan political posturing over a matter which at last analysis is a matter of constitutional procedure. No substantive policy position, party position, is jeopardized. Would not a bit of comity and senatorial courtesy make sense with respect to confirmation procedures that any newly elected president will face? Will instead the next election turn out to be only another chapter in the story of a divided, unhappy country, seemingly unable to deal with deficits and debts, mired in ideological disputes? Or, in what I would like to think of as a true democratic tradition, can a new election mark a turn in attitudes, a willingness to take a fresh look at what needs to be done, and an incentive to work together in the common interest? We can't know the answer to those questions, but there can't be any doubt as to where Pat Moynihan would stand, in fact, where he stood all his life, in searching for ways and means of bringing the country together, and in the process, using all the force of available evidence, collegial debate, and common sense. And I must say that is the reason I take great pride in the prize you have extended to me this evening. Thank you very much. Thank you.